Hello, everyone. I'm Sam.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Mo.
And this is Team Get Over It.
We're an all-female team participating in the greatest motoring adventure on the planet, the Mongol Rally.
We'll be driving 10,000 miles across mountains, deserts, and unknown terrain.
And along the way, we hope to spread our feminist and environmental ideals.
Join us here as we share our stories, thoughts, and interviews as we get ready for the Mongol Rally 2021.
Don't you mean 2022?
Shit! Hello!
Welcome back, everyone.
About two episodes ago, we talked about some of the amazing athletes that showcased their talent and skills during the 2020 Tokyo Olympics this year.
Not only did those athletes achieve many firsts in their disciplines and for their countries, but many also used their platforms and voices to call for change.
I think no one would argue that this past Olympics marked a change in sports. A change for the better, I might add, which is especially amazing given all the challenges facing the organizers, spectators, and athletes because of the pandemic.
We wanted to round out the episode by gaining an insider's perspective on professional sports, and we were extremely fortunate to be introduced to an athlete who participated in this year's Olympics, Aisha Pratt-Lear.
Yay.
Hello, welcome. Yay.
So hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming.
So Aisha, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your sport and hobbies, etc.?
Yes. I am a professional track athlete. I live in Boulder, Colorado. I run for Puma and am a part of a female-dominated training group of professionals called Team Boss. I grew up in Illinois and am a dual citizen with the U.S. and Jamaica. I run internationally for Jamaica, primarily the 1500. I dabble in the 5K and am a former steeplechaser.
That's really cool.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Oh, also hobbies and other things I'm interested in. That takes up a lot of my time. But when I'm not doing that, I like walking my dog, Leuven, who's named after a small Belgian city where I met my husband. I love cooking and reading, and I don't like cats, but my life is very similar to an indoor cat when I'm not training. I'm just snuggled up, eating snacks and being cozy.
Love it.
Nice.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. So how did you first become interested in running?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I really looked up to Allyson Felix when I was a kid. I don't know how I became a fan of hers, but I always liked the Olympics, and I must have seen a commercial or something when I was a kid. So I always had her poster on my wall, and I was a sprinter in middle school, and I really liked her, but I was interested in some other sports, and I really fell into running because of a friend. And I loved the social aspect of cross country and running with my friends. And I liked the people that were on the team, and I liked the coaches. And so I was definitely a social runner, and then just ended up being really good at it.
Oh, that's amazing.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of things kind of start out like that, like, you know, just a hobby or a hero. And then it just sort of like keeps going from there.
Totally.
And yeah, And Allyson Felix, I have heard a little bit about her, and I think, like, most impressively, it's recently, I think she kind of got rid of her sponsorships and she kind of created her own shoe line, right?
Yeah. She was sponsored by some big shoe companies, and then she ended up being sponsored by Athleta, the clothing company, and then she started her own shoe line to cater to women, because a lot of footwear brands don't necessarily make shoes specifically for women. So she started doing that, which is really cool.
Yeah, she's from what I've read about her, I'd like to read a little bit more, but she seems like a really, like, strong person.
Yeah.
Looks like an amazing person. Yeah, she's really cool.
Okay. When I was a kid, I just liked her because she was fast. But she was
when you're a kid, everything's so much more simple.
Yeah, when I mean, she's not that much older than me. I'm not sure her actual age, but she was just a sort of child, young adult phenom. So that's how I became her fan. But she, I mean, has evolved so much as a person, as we all do when we age, and it's really cool to see her evolution.
Yeah, that's really cool. So how did you feel when you won your gold medal at the Commonwealth Games in 2018 and your silver medal at the Pan American Games in 2019?
When I won gold at Commonwealth Games, it was one of the happiest moments of my life. It's interesting to grow up in a sport where you're sort of used to winning, and then once you go professional, you don't win very often. It's really hard to win races as a pro. And that has been the biggest, or that was the biggest race, is the biggest race I've ever won. And I'd really put my mind to that specific goal. And a lot of people, you know, talk about how important it is to worry about the process, think of the results later, but I was really invested in that result. And I do think that it paid off, and I'd visualized it so many times, and for it to actually happen was just the most, it was just one of the most amazing moments of my life. I was totally on top of the world to achieve something that I had wanted so deeply. And it was really fun, and how the race played out was really fun. And it was also a historic moment for Jamaica, because we, up until then, didn't have any medals of any color at any international competition above 800 wow. meters. So it was a huge moment for our country. And at that Games, we hadn't particularly been nailing it. Up until that moment, we hadn't been winning a lot of medals. We were sort of having a rough time. So to hit that one win gold was shocking to a lot of people, and then really snowballed a lot of positive momentum. So it was good for a lot of reasons. My parents were down in Australia. It was so cool for them. My coach had flown all the way there. So it was a really great day. And then when I won silver at Pan Ams, that was awesome. It was, again, another sort of monument for Jamaican sport. That was, so my gold in 2018 was in the 3000 meter steeplechase, and then my silver in Pan Ams was in the 1500. And again, no Jamaicans had ever won a medal in that distance. So that was also really cool to be a part of. It was a much different vibe in Lima. It was chilly and kind of like spitting rain, and that was a really kind of surreal day. It was sort of overcast all day. It felt super dark. It was under these really bright lights. The track was really cool. It was a smaller stadium, but that was a really fun competition. And I would say that was like a, if the Commonwealth was the highest high, that was more like a medium high, but it was still really awesome.
That's really cool. I've never competed at a level like higher than like high school. I'm just like, yeah, high school got hard. I'm done. I mean, admittedly, I'm not really into doing sports for competitiveness. Like, I'm super competitive, but like with board games.
Yeah, I'm also competitive with the board games. Yeah.
No, I can kind of, I mean, not quite, not that I've ever played professionally, but yeah, I used to, when I was a kid, I used to play softball, and then, but we were sort of like, what is it? A big fish in a small pond. So in like every year, whenever we went to softball tournaments, my team would always just like absolutely murder the other teams.
Awesome.
Yeah. but then when we went to like Eastern Canadians, however, and we were with a lot more teams, we would be the ones getting slaughtered. So
less fun.
Less, but you know what? Less fun, but it's sort of, you know, at the same time, it's kind of, how can I say?
Learning
experience? It's humbling, but it's also, it's humbling, but it's also kind of like inspiring. Cause like, if you do have that competitive spirit, because I played with a lot of girls who like kind of eventually went on to like the Canadian national team.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so like, you know, for them, they, you know, they just were like, I want to do better, and they, you know, because I think like once when you're on top, there's not really much motivation to improve.
Totally.
Yeah,
it's fun to see how good you could be at something,
and right,
in a way it's like, oh wow, like somebody does something really impressive, you're like, wow, like you start picturing like, what if I could do that?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just very inspired by like your drive to not only visualize what you want to see happening, but actualizing it, like just not just being like, yeah, I'm gonna go do this thing, be like, no, I'm gonna go do this thing, and just tell yourself that every day, and then you do it and you're just like, yes. Like that satisfaction, I'm sure, was just amazing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Okay, and then kind of, I guess, building on that, what was your most memorable race, and then what made it so memorable?
I think my most memorable race was in 2018. Leading into Commonwealth Games, I decided to run World Indoor Championships. They were in Birmingham, UK, and I was running the 1500, and it was a beyond stacked field of sort of the best of the best of all time. Women indoor races are the track is shorter, so instead of a 400 meter track, you're on a 200 meter bank track. The fields are a little bit smaller, and the races are like really exciting. I think because you're doubling your lap count, and it feels like really sort of gritty, intimate racing. And this is my most memorable race because it is, I still think, the hardest I've ever run in my life. And a group of women at some point, usually in a championship race, it starts out kind of slower and everyone's just sort of jockeying for position. And then there's this blistering moment where the race changes and some people break out and start running really fast. And this happened in this race, and I was, you know, mentally prepared for that. But the speed at which the pace changed and how fast that we were going after the pace change was pretty much as fast as I could run for a kilometer. And it was so hard that I don't even remember what happened. After the race, I couldn't tell you what place I was. I was just flat out horizontal on the track. Somebody had to scoop me up. And it felt like my legs, it felt like there wasn't enough skin to cover the muscles of my legs. Like my legs were just exploding. And that is so memorable to me because I'd never hurt that bad before. And I think that just sort of propelled me to the next level of running, where I knew I could take my body to a place that I previously wasn't sure that I could, or like had never been. So that was a big turning point for me. And I ended up being sixth. So sixth in the world was pretty cool.
Amazing.
Yeah, it really hurt. So it's kind of fun.
And then as far as, because I know too, this is kind of like a sidebar, but I know too that like recently you had an injury, right? Are you fully recovered now?
Yeah, I'm not fully recovered. I had a freak knee injury. I did a total medial meniscus root tear, where your meniscus itself doesn't tear. It just tears off of the bone. Which sucks.
Sounds painful.
It was very painful. You pretty much lose complete knee stability because your meniscus essentially just gets squeezed outside of your knee when you step. So you encounter like a bit of a bone on bone situation. But yeah, it's not a running injury. It was just a freak injury. I was in Switzerland training for Tokyo. The doctor there said, you know, there's no way you'll race in Tokyo, but I ended up getting a hold of, thankfully, a friend at the U.S. Olympic Training Center, a former doctor there, got me in touch with a surgeon who fully supported me running at the Olympics and said that, you know, I can try to get my knee drained, get a cortisone injection in my knee, and then get on the starting line and see if that's possible. As long as I don't really train leading into it. Right. So that was, you know, it made the Tokyo Olympics not really what I had planned for myself, but I was really proud of myself for still going there. I still beat a couple of people in my race. I didn't advance to the next round. Yeah, I'm glad I made it there, but I'm 10 or 11 weeks post-op. I started walking 3 weeks ago. And yeah, everything's on track, but it's just a really slow recovery that I wasn't necessarily planning for. banking on this injury. So it's definitely a bit of a curveball, but I'm handling it well.
That's good. I mean, you seem like you're in very high spirits about it, about it after the fact. My brother had like a torn meniscus when he was in high school for football.
Oh, yeah, that probably does not feel good.
No, he spent basically the rest of the – it was like the first or second game of his senior year's high school season. And he blew out his knee in the kickoff of the game.
Oh, no.
And so he basically spent the rest of the game on the sidelines, went to the hospital, and then spent the rest of the season just be like, go team, from the sidelines. But he was like really proud of his team, but he was just well, gotta rechange my life's goals, okay. So I was just like, yes, sucks. I've seen how bad that can hurt and like how long that takes. And I'm just like, you got this.
Yeah, yes. That'll get you.
Yes. We wish you a speedy recovery.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So, I mean, kind of along the lines that we've already been talking about, but what was it like preparing for the 2020 Olympics?
Yeah, I guess like other than the injury.
Yeah, other than the injury, it was longer process. It was a longer buildup than we thought, having the extra year, making it to be the 2021 games. It was different. I mean, I was home way more than I ever have been in my professional career. Last training camps, during the quarantine year, we didn't meet as a team. So there's a lot more solo training. But you know, I consider myself a lucky one. I was still able to keep my job and keep training and go outside, run, come back inside. It was really not, I was really, really lucky in the sense that my life stayed very similar. I mean, it was just far less social, far, far, far less travel and no competition. But beyond that, it was great. I mean, I got in some great training. I really got in some good quality time with my husband, which we don't necessarily get when I'm flying all over the world. So it was good. And yeah, training went well and I enjoyed it. You know, I'm 31 years old and the fact that I'm still loving full-time athlete life is a sort of a testament to the people that I surround myself with. It could get tedious, could get really hard. I couldn't, you know, could have fallen out of love with it, but I'm still loving it.
That's amazing.
Because I think I know your husband is also a professional runner, right?
Yeah, he recently retired and is now transitioning into his next career. He's still working in sport and working with his sponsor and his agent. But yeah, it's also really handy when your husband is a professional athlete and can train with you during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
So that was lovely.
There you go.
So that was definitely a benefit.
Whoa, that's nice. Great. So, so this is kind of like the nitty gritty part of the interview, I think, this question. But so what difficulties do athletes face kind of like in their careers or even in their daily lives, and especially athletes that belong to marginalized groups?
I think there's a lot of potential difficulties, and one of the roles that I cherish the most in sporting life is I sit on the Athletes Commission for World Athletics. So for our international governing body, I am an athlete advocate. And one of the pieces of work I did this last year was to sort of create a human rights framework to help World Athletics make decisions in the future. And there is so much that athletes face, particularly in marginalized groups, particularly internationally, that a lot of athletes don't think about. And one of, I think, two of the most egregious situations that's happening right under our noses is happening a lot in East Africa, where men are sort of predatory toward female athletes, sort of forcing them into marriage and dictating that they take performance enhancing drugs, making, you know, forcing them into these careers and racing and taking their money, and the women are trapped. And this, you know, there was a huge investigative journalism piece that came out about this, and it's really, really, really rampant in Kenya, and it's so difficult to protect international athletes, where you don't have protections in place. There are no unions. There are no. It's really hard for a governing body to crack down on certain things, and it's really sad, and it's really hard. And another thing that's happening is that World Athletics has tried to put a stop to is certain wealthier countries sort of buying athletes to compete for them. So taking athletes who are in a disadvantaged position, saying, you know, we will pay, you'll never have to work again, you can support your entire town or village or family on this money that we'll give you, so long as you come compete for us. And a lot of that gets ugly with performance enhancing drugs and you know, money for medals and things like this, or, you know, guaranteed citizenship if you, you know, win this medal. But you know, that gets sort of becomes into like a web of drugs and lying. And so there are really, really ugly avenues that sport can weasel its way down. But then, you know, on the other side, to bring it to like a less really bleak thought here, is that it's also, I think track is one of the best avenues for in America for athletes in marginalized groups to create opportunity. It's the sport that has probably the lowest barrier to entry in schools. There's typically no cuts in U.S. high schools, U.S. middle schools. It's sort of a come one, come all. You don't need a ton of expensive equipment to join a track team. You could just have an old beat up pair of shoes and, you know, the ability to stay after school and you belong. And that has been my experience in the sport. And I think the way that the NCAA system is set up currently in America, a lot of people, doesn't matter where you come from, what your background is, are finding a lot of success, are finding opportunity, are finding college scholarship, are finding you know, ways to improve their lives through specifically track and field, because it is such a welcoming sport. There are many disciplines. You don't have to just be a runner. You can be a thrower. You can be a jumper. You can be a vaulter. There are so many avenues for lots of people from anywhere to come in and find a place and belong.
Wow. Whoa. That's good. That's really nice to know.
So amazing and so much information to just kind of digest for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, really took you on a lap there.
Yeah. We're getting our mental exercise in for the day.
Yeah.
There yeah. You go. And it's, well, for me anyway, it's only 6:30 a.m.
Yeah. Hello. Good morning.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Good morning. But yeah, so after kind of hearing that, so, because I know that you're half Jamaican. Mm-hmm. And then when you made the decision to kind of like compete for Jamaica, what was your main motivator for that, or your main inspiration for that?
Yeah, I so track and field in Jamaica is behind football, soccer, mm-hmm. the most popular sport in the country, and track athletes are national heroes. And traditionally, Jamaican track athletes dominate the sprints internationally. And I wanted to, and I still want to, broaden that horizon and bring more women, particularly young women, into the middle distances and be a representative of the country, such that if a younger woman sees someone that they can emulate, that they might want to step into that too. So to show young girls that, look, I can run the 1500 and have success. There are more avenues to be successful than just the 100 meters. And right. That's really, really been important to me, to sort of be that representation.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I think that somewhat answers a bit of the last question.
Many athletes like Ansan, Simone Biles, the German gymnastics team, Allison Felix, and more use their positions as world-round athletes to highlight problems and encourage change both within sports and without. Do you think that athletes have a responsibility to use their voice to speak out against social injustices?
I think it's personal. And for me, I feel a personal responsibility, but I know of a lot of athletes who don't necessarily feel comfortable. And I think that's okay. I really do. I think that the decision for me is a no-brainer. It's not really a decision. This is the way I think and feel, and I will share that. And I feel passionately about something, so I'll try to work to change it. But I know a lot of people who do feel passionately, and just work quietly, to enact change around them, or to, strengthen relationships, or to do their work, quietly. And I respect that decision too. I think I really, 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 look up to those athletes who make the decision to speak out publicly, to act publicly. But I think that the most important thing is the action piece. And it's easy to talk, it's harder to do. And the athletes who are affecting change, I think, are incredibly impressive. And I really love to see athletes speaking up and opening that door to others, particularly with the conversations around mental health this summer. That's just been in the past such a taboo. And professional athletes were made to sort of seem like soldiers, or I don't know, like what Roman battle people, you know. It's just like
gladiators.
Yes, that I'm looking for the word. Yeah, like gladiators. But we're human, and I think that those conversations this summer were really essential. And I think I've seen even firsthand a lot of athletes struggle with mental health over my career, but not really understand what they're looking at or feeling, because it hadn't really been discussed before. So from social justice reform to mental health to human rights, and all of this that these public people are taking on and speaking up and taking action about, I think, is really, really admirable. But I don't think you can prescribe a should to all athletes. I think if they're, bringing just by being a public figure, being a sports person, being someone for a community of people to root for, I think that's a net positive.
Mm. And yeah. If you're comfortable answering this one, what social issues are personally important to you?
Yeah, I've got three things that are pretty important to me. One is moving middle distance in Jamaica forward for young women. Mm-hmm. Two is equity in education in the U.S. So last summer, my training group raised $30,000 for a group called the Sachs Foundation, who provides college scholarships to Black students in Colorado. That is education to me is one of the biggest opportunities that that I want to support for Black students in my community and in the U.S. And then the third, which I've really encountered more in this last year, is human rights reform in sport. It's, to me, wild that track and field is a bit behind in this realm of not necessarily having the biggest world athletics level, not having like a very clear format of like how they make decisions, and not necessarily having people on staff that are guiding decisions for the federation, but they've committed to changing all of that. So I really have been put a lot of time into that this past year. So I'm really proud of the work that my group did and the work that World Athletics, our governing body, has committed to do moving forward. So those are the sort of three things that are on my mind week to week.
I think that's amazing. And I totally agree. I think one of my coworkers and I, we talk a lot about the education system, and like as a teacher, that's something that also resonates with me. And some places in America just have absolutely atrocious systems in place that really
totally
disadvantage marginalized groups and stuff. And so I think that's really awesome that you and others are like working.
It's wild that education in America is largely funded by property tax.
Well, and it how widely it varies is also very surprising. Like I've been able to experience the education system in the U.S. in four different states because my family was military and we moved around a lot. So I got to experience it in Alaska, which you would think would be, maybe subpar because it's really rural, it's out in the middle of nowhere. But we actually had I had the best kind of broad spectrum. Like we covered all the subjects. It was very objective about everything that we talked about, and didn't focus on one detail of this war, but didn't talk about anything else. Like it talked about a little bit of everything. It was very broad spectrum, and I felt very well rounded from there. And then go to Louisiana, and it's very closed minded. We were using textbooks from the 50s. And I was just like, oh, okay. And then I was kind of lucky, unlucky, I'm not sure. I consider kind of lucky because I was able to move schools again almost immediately after starting school in Louisiana, just because Hurricane Katrina happened. And my family got displaced because of it, and so we moved to Illinois, where it was a little bit more of a well-rounded, but there were aspects of it that were very kind of nitpicky. They focused on this aspect more in a historical aspect than focusing on this. And they pushed more of this aspect of English education, reading these certain books versus reading other books for your English classes. And then when I moved back to the West Coast, it was a little bit more of a broad spectrum again, but it was just how widely it varied depending on which state you were living in. It was just surprising.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. And not many people realize that, you know, depending on what state you're in, depends on like kind of the level you're getting and like what standards are required versus what ones aren't.
Depending on the state, and then depending on like which part of town you live in.
The school district, the state, everything. Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. Like as a Canadian, like because our I think our education system, like public education system, is more or less equal across the board. So whenever I'm reading about this kind of stuff, like it's honestly like it's infuriating because like America is such a rich country, and yet they're honestly like they're actively disenfranchising, like disadvantaging certain people, groups. And of course it's certain groups, certain ethnic groups and stuff, and it's just I can't believe that that's still happening in this day and age. It's
hard for it to not be obviously systemic.
Of course,
and people try to deny that it is, but you're like, well, I mean,
yeah,
I'm looking at it and it clearly is. You can deny deny all you want,
looks like a duck, sounds like a duck.
It's a duck. It's not a goose. It's a duck. And no matter how much you try to navigate that river in Egypt, it's not going to help.
Good Lord.
Denial.
That's anyway, right. hopefully it, because I think a lot of people are becoming aware of these kinds of issues, especially like, you know, 2019 and like, 2000, well, just the last couple of years. Anyway. So hopefully we'll see a change sooner than later. I hope.
Yeah.
That would be nice. Yeah. So, but anyway, I think that's all we have time for today. Aisha, thank you so much for agreeing to this interview today. It was really insightful. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we, Mo and I and our listeners have really learned a lot. So anyway, thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much. I definitely have learned a lot because I knew nothing about the world of professional athletes at all. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It was great to chat with you.
Yeah. And if our listeners want to know more about you and follow your career, where and how can they do that?
I'm most active on Instagram at Aisha Protlier.
Oh, good. Right. And we'll include that information like in the description of this episode so people can easily find you. Awesome. So that's really great. Yeah. So anyway, thanks again for coming onto our podcast. We've really enjoyed talking to you.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like this episode, please comment. Please like, comment, subscribe, etc., as it really helps us out and reach more people.
So we also have a Patreon where we publish extra content and conduct AMAs. Link in the description. See you next time.
Bye for now.
That's it for today, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in.
And as always, please support this work by subscribing and donating to our cause at www.teamgetoverit.com.
Donors get access to specific content like stickers, t-shirts, and postcards from our journey.
You can donate for as little as $5 and the benefits build from there.
Go to our website for more info or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Team Get Over It.
Thanks for listening and catch us next time on Get Over It.